Today's episode is sponsored by the Star Trek Starships Collection, the ultimate collection officially authorized by CBS Studios. Featuring vessels from 50 years of Star Trek, each is expertly sculpted, hand-painted, and comes with an authoritative collector's magazine. Start your collection today with the USS Enterprise 1701D, that's from The Next Generation, for only $4.95 with free shipping. For details and to order, visit st-starships.com/random. That's st-starships.com/random. My thanks to the Star Trek Starships Collection, who also happened to send me three of the ships, and they are pretty awesome. Welcome back to Random Trek, the podcast in which I, your host, Scott McNulty, discuss a random episode of Star Trek with a non-random guest. My non-random guest tonight is Marshall Onaroff. Marshall, thank you for joining me.
Scott, thank you so much for having me. I'm really psyched to be on the show.
Oh, we got a pretty good episode to talk about. But before we jump into geeking out on Star Trek, tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
Sure. Well, my name is Marshall Onaroff. I'm a senior writer for Tom's Guide. We're a consumer tech review, news, and analysis site. And one of our sister sites is space.com, which is how I've done some of my Star Trek writing. I recently completed a project in which I watched all of Star Trek beginning to end, starting with Enterprise, going up through Voyager in the movies. It took a long time.
How long did it take you?
Well, with pauses for other shows, including Breaking Bad and Parks and Rec, which, by the way, I just want to plug those as excellent shows as well. It took me about 3.5 years, a little bit less.
That's an impressive time commitment. And so what did you learn? I'll link to the – you wrote an article or a series of articles about this, so I'll link to that so people could read it.
Thank you.
But what did you learn in your binge of all this Star Trek?
Well, I learned that I grew up as more of a casual Trek fan, and I learned that wasn't enough. I love Star Trek. It's a really special series, and I still haven't found anything quite like it because it's one of the few series, science fiction series, that portrays technology and technological advancement as a universally positive thing for humanity.
That is true. I mean, I guess the dark side of the technological advancement is the Borg, I suppose, right? So that shows us what we shouldn't be. But generally, technology is good in Star Trek.
Generally, yes. And that's why I think the Borg are an important race. But maybe when we talk about a Borg episode someday.
That's true. No Borg. And just so people know, which they already do because they're listening to this, they've seen the title of the episode, we're going to be talking about Elementary Dear Data, which is a TNG episode, season 2, episode 3. One of these episodes that makes me think, why are they allowed to have holodecks on starships? We'll get into that shortly. So you watched in chronological order, it sounds like, because you started with, well, you know, Star Trek chronological order. So you started with Enterprise.
Yep.
And I assume ended with – so did you include the J.J. Abrams reboot movies in this?
Yes. I watched those two at the very end because I figured that the first one takes place after Nemesis and the second one right after that. So I figured I'd just save those to the last two things.
All right. So you've done all the survey work. So I have to ask, which series ended up being your favorite series?
It was very close, and between more series than I thought. It wasn't just down to two. It was probably about three or four competing for the top spot. But ultimately, I think I still like the original the best. I thought that for an episode-by-episode basis, it had the best balance of action, thematic lessons, a little bit of starship combat, which I really like, something Enterprise actually did well, doesn't get enough credit for, in my opinion. But something about the original series, I like that every single episode has some kind of societal lesson to it, which even TNG doesn't always accomplish.
Yes, that is true. And I think, and I've said this before, I think it is amazing when you look at the original series, particularly the first season, how good that first season of TV is.
Oh, yeah. And then just dive right in. It didn't take any time at all for the show to hit its stride, maybe three or four episodes.
I know, it's crazy. And then you compare and contrast that to every other series of Star Trek, and they've had mixed results in their first seasons, I feel like.
Yeah.
So I have to ask now the converse of that question. What was your least favorite? I won't say the one that you didn't like, but your least favorite series.
Well, I will say there is something to like in every series, but at the risk of giving a cop-out answer, I thought the animated series was much weaker than the other five.
Now, see, this is a controversial subject here on Random Trek because I do not include the animated series in my list of random episodes and movies to include. And some people, upset is a strong word, but some people disagree with my not including it. But I feel like, sure, when I first started this podcast, it was hard to find the animated series, so it wasn't available on streaming. And so that was my easy cop-out answer. And then now it is available on streaming, but I still don't want to include it because it's just not – I don't feel like it counts.
There are a handful of good episodes, but I generally agree with you. If you want my least favorite of the live-action ones, probably Voyager. I still like a lot about Voyager, but I feel that Enterprise got – very, very good in seasons 3 and 4. And
but the season 1 and 2 of Enterprise, though, man.
Oh, no. Not as good as Trek gets.
Probably as bad as Trek gets, I think.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I would agree that seasons 3 and 4 of Enterprise are good. But I still think Enterprise ranks as my least favorite just because of those first two seasons. And the fact that, I don't know, just the crew is not my favorite. I like Dr. Phlox a lot. I like Porthos a lot. Yes. T'Pol has her moments, but then everybody else, I feel like I can't even remember most of their names, which is never a good sign. And I host a Star Trek podcast.
Yes.
So that's a bad thing. And people who listen to this show know my feelings about Captain Archer, which are not positive.
Oh, see, that's where we could get into something interesting on a different type of subject. But I happen to like Archer a lot. I know it's a bit of a controversial opinion, and that would take another 40 minutes to expound. But that's one of the reasons why I think I'd prioritize Enterprise over Voyager, because Archer is a very interesting character. Not always perfect, but I like his arc.
Oh, so you like Archer. You go Archer over Janeway, then.
Yeah, I think I would. Although Janeway is a terrific captain. I think that all the captains really have something great going for them. I don't have any huge complaints about any one of them as a character.
And I should be clear that, you know, I like all Star Trek, so it's just, you know, grading them amongst all the things that I like. Like naming my favorite children. I don't have any children, so it's easy enough. But you know what I mean. But I will say from the captains, Archer is my least favorite captain. But I still, you know, I like him. I just feel like he's a bit of a stick in the mud. I know that was kind of a choice. You know, he's the first captain. He's, out there exploring things, and he is reacting in kind of as a realistic way as possible, in given the setting, right? But I don't know. Plus, he likes water polo. Who likes water polo?
Well, under the right circumstances, can't be fun.
Although, once again, cute dog. So, hooray for him.
Yep.
But we're not here to talk about Voyager or Enterprise, even though seemingly the random number generator really loves both Enterprise and Voyager. A lot of those episodes show up, which is surprising because Enterprise only had 4 seasons. Next Generation. What are your thoughts about the Next Generation in general?
Well, Next Generation is the way I got introduced to Star Trek in the first place. The first time I ever saw it, I was 11 years old, and my dad took me to see Insurrection, which is open in theaters.
Mm.
And admittedly, not the best way to get introduced to Star Trek, but if you've never seen it before, that movie will blow your mind. It's got a moral lesson. It's got action. It's got space battles. It's got all these interesting characters. I was hooked as soon as I saw that, so TNG occupies a very special place in my heart because I saw those movies first, and when I was in high school, they used to show it every night on Spike, and that's how I got caught up with the episodes in the first place.
And Insurrection has the skin-stretching scenes, which always kind of freak me out. So that is an interesting way to be introduced to the Next Generation, and you wanted to see more after seeing Insurrection, which I guess is good. So who's your favorite character on the Next Generation?
Ooh, you said about choosing favorite children, that's
questions here.
I think to go with my gut, I'd probably say Commander Riker. I dressed up for him as Halloween. I grew the beard out and slicked my hair back and everything.
That seems like the obvious choice.
I think there is something very charming about Riker, but there's also things genuine about him. There are some hard choices he has to make. He's more thoughtful than he lets on, and I get the sense that he genuinely likes the people under him, and he genuinely likes Captain Picard, and he makes a real effort to get along with everyone, and he's not superficial, even though he seems like a character who easily could be.
Right. You feel like he genuinely wants to know and cares about the people that report to him. Not that Captain Picard doesn't, but Captain Picard is very much kind of at arm's length. He isn't like a touchy-feely captain. I feel like Captain Janeway is much more of like she wants to sit down with you and talk and, you know, talk out the problems and figure out what's going on with your life. And Captain Picard doesn't really want to talk to you. He wants the status report, and then he wants you to talk to him if he needs something from you. But yet you respect him. But if you have a problem, you don't go to him, you go to Riker.
Exactly. But of all the captains, I think I'd want to serve under Picard. There is something incredibly upright about his very, very consistent and thoughtful moral code. And he's the kind of the captain that you want to be.
Exactly. You look up to him, you want to emulate him, but he isn't the kind of guy that you would probably feel comfortable with, just small talk in the turbo lift.
Exactly.
You probably would not. You just hope, I hope he doesn't notice that I'm here. I don't want to screw anything up, or spill my hot chocolate all over his uniform. People get that reference, I'm sure. So season two is an interesting time in The Next Generation because we say goodbye to Dr. Crusher. We say hello to Dr. Pulaski for one season. What do you think about Dr. Pulaski? She's a very kind of controversial, is probably too much a strong word, but a polarizing, that's a better word.
Yeah, character. Polarizing, I think divisive maybe.
Yes.
It's a good word. I understand the criticisms of her, and like everyone else, the first couple episodes, I didn't like her at all. Mm-hmm. I thought she was hard-headed. She made no effort to interact with the rest of the crew. She was deliberately dismissive. But she did open up. She did give people a chance. And from a personal perspective, she reminded me a lot of a chemistry teacher I had in high school. I had the same kind of prickly personality. But once you got to know her, she really knew her stuff. And I felt kind of the same way about Dr. Pulaski.
And the reason I didn't like Dr. Pulaski, and this episode I think is a perfect showcase for that, is that she's always mean to Data. And Data is probably, if I had to pick my favorite character on The Next Generation, it would probably be Data. And in this episode, she's basically like, well, you're just a machine. You can't really think about anything. You're only solving these mysteries because you know all of these things. If you were given a real mystery, you would fail. And it's okay. And she calls him our friend a lot to Geordi, which is, you know, the way she says it, you're like, oh man, you're really making me angry, Dr. Pulaski.
And that was one of the things that never really got resolved in that season. She starts off being very, very mean to Data, and then she gets a little less mean to him as the season goes on, but the two of them never really reconcile or become friends the way that Pulaski and Worf do.
Yeah, and she – I always remember her calling him Data, but I feel like she called him Data in this episode, or maybe I was just correcting it in my head.
No, I think that in episode one or two, after being repeatedly corrected, she finally calls him Data as a tiny bit of a concession to maybe starting to respect him as a person.
This piece of equipment seems to have ideas about what he wants people to call him.
Yes.
Oh, Dr. Pulaski. That being said, she is very – like the actress does a good job of playing this character. I don't particularly like the choices that the writers gave her, but I think she does a good job being Dr. Pulaski, if that makes any sense.
Oh, it makes sense to me, and I'm happy that – she was there for a season and we got to know the character, and I'm also happy that Dr. Crusher came back.
Yes, she's no Dr. Crusher. We can all agree on that. And I think behind the scenes, there was some contract negotiations and you know, those kind of shenanigans. So, things happen. But then all is right in the world. Dr. Crusher's back, and we're all happy, although not in this episode. So this is a pretty famous episode, although I think the sequel to this episode is probably better known. Which happens four seasons later or something like that.
I actually read about that. Apparently there was some kind of contract dispute with the Arthur Conan Doyle estate. Mm-hmm. Even though the Sherlock Holmes books are, for most purposes, public domain, if they want to be on television, there's some sort of payout that has to happen. And they said, until we can resolve this, you can't do another Sherlock Holmes episode. And it took them 3 or 4 years to iron that out.
Our next sponsor is our good pals at Blue Apron. Now, you've heard me talk about Blue Apron before, and I sound excited because Blue Apron is just a fantastic concept and a great time saver if you want to eat high quality food and cook it yourself, but just don't have the time to shop or maybe you just don't have, like me, the gift of cooking. I have trouble cooking spaghetti correctly, but Blue Apron comes, they give you they send you this box. It's a subscription service. They send you a box that's full of delicious ingredients, half of which I have never heard of, and they give you a card that has colorful and concise directions that tells you exactly how to cook the meal that you have gotten in this box. The best part, there's no measuring because everything is pre-measured. So if you're like me and you see the abbreviation and you think, is that a teaspoon or a tablespoon? And which is different? Can I use any spoon? Can I use this wooden spoon? Chances are, no, you can't. Blue Apron is for you. It sounds expensive, but for less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron will deliver you seasonal recipes with pre-portioned ingredients, and you make delicious home-cooked meals. I have done it. That's how easy it is. And the ingredients, let me tell you, they are top-notch. They're stuff like Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes. If you're anything like me, you go to the supermarket, and now there's a surprising variety of tomatoes. There used to be a time, children, when you went to the supermarket, there was one tomato, one kind of tomato, not just one tomato. This is in Soviet Russia. And you would pick the one because that was the only one. But now, this resurgence of food culture, there's the heirloom tomatoes, many varieties of tomatoes. I don't know how to pick the right tomato, but with Blue Apron, they send you the right one. So I know what you're thinking. Scott, what meals are available in July? Well, I'm glad you thought that, because I have a list right in front of me. They include spinach and basil pesto gnocchi with summer squash, green beans, and fresh mozzarella, spiced pork tacos with avocado, pickled onion, and elote-style corn, which I don't know what that is, but I'm sure it's delicious, summer vegetable pizza with garlic, lemon, broccolini. I actually had some broccolini last night. Broccolini is delicious. So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals. That's right, three meals for free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/trek. That's blueapron.com/trek. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So don't wait. That's blueapron.com/trek. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. And so this episode is another. In the first season, there was the episode where Captain Picard plays a detective, and now all the details are totally escaping my mind. Dixon Hill. There you go. And so it's a big set piece, right? He goes to the holodeck. He's playing this hard-boiled kind of noir detective, and he needs to, you know, solve some mysteries. So this season's version of that is Data apparently is a big fan of Sherlock Holmes. And so he wants to go to the holodeck, although it's Geordi's idea, go to the holodeck and solve some Sherlock Holmes mysteries. And they have this opportunity because in what I think is, you know, Starfleet, the more I watch a Star Trek, I mean, I've watched a lot of Star Trek, but not with a super critical eye, the more I question how Starfleet is run. So the Enterprise, which is the flagship of the Starfleet, right? And you would think it has a lot of things to do. But for some reason, it's rendezvousing with the USS Victory, and it shows up 3 days early. And Captain Picard basically says, we have nothing to do, so we're just kind of hanging out here for 3 days. And I thought to myself, that seems like an inefficient use of resources.
Yes, but at the same time, I sort of see the logic in doing these deep space missions and having a couple days buffer time built in to just catch up on things, maybe unwind a little as Data and Geordi do, because they're not at star bases very often. They're not at planets very often. So just to have some time to gather your thoughts and keep it together for when you have those really important missions. But maybe that's just me putting my own spin on things.
Well, that sounds, and as you were talking, I was thinking about, you know, how many episodes have we seen where the Enterprise is en route to some particular rendezvous or mission and they got sidetracked by some unexpected spatial anomaly or something? So perhaps they just build in a lot of, they pad the schedule because they know that the Enterprise is never going to show up on time because they fall into like a wormhole or gravitational anomaly or something. And this time they just avoided all the anomalies. So they had 3 days of bonus time.
Well, you know, even in Star Trek, space travel is not an exact science. There are a lot of things that can happen when you're going from point A to point B and utilizing faster than light technology.
It's true. And they always seem to happen to the characters that we know. So
very convenient.
It's right. And we never see the USS Victory either. So I was hoping at the end we would see, you know, because I like the spaceships. I will admit to it.
Wasn't there a glimpse right before the end credits of the Victory?
Was there? Maybe I blinked and missed it.
I think so. I forget what kind of class ship it was, but it's there just the very, very end.
I missed it. All I saw was the lovely and gigantic model that Geordi makes of the original USS Victory that apparently he makes in the middle of engineering.
I wondered about that too. You'd think it'd get in someone's way.
It seems odd. So yeah, Geordi was an ensign. He served on the USS Victory. So as a present, he makes, he builds this, I guess, from hand. He rigged it from hand. Certainly, I don't know if he built the whole thing. Model of the, you know, sailboat. Although I'm sure it's not called. It's a ship, but I don't know. I don't know my nautical terms. It's a lovely big model ship that he builds on a table in engineering. And everyone seems cool with it because I guess he's in charge, so he does what he wants.
Yeah, people don't argue with Geordi too much when he sets up in the engineering.
And plus, they're not doing anything. They got there 3 days early, so yeah. Who cares? Although that model looks like it took a long time to build, so I'm not sure when he started. But Data, not so impressed. I mean, he's impressed with it, but he's like, why would you do this? Why would you make it? Can't you just replicate it? And that's when Geordi. I mean, this is one of those, you know, very special episodes where Data's supposed to learn some things about what it means to be human. And he learns part of, you know, the joy of doing something like this is doing it yourself, not just, you know, pressing a button and having it done. And so the captain of the USS Victory will appreciate it more because he knows Geordi did it by hand for him or her. I don't know if they told us what the gender of this captain was.
And I thought it was interesting, too, that this is an episode where whatever else happens, Data sort of learns the value of play. I don't remember if there are any episodes in season one where he specifically took time out of his schedule just to play and have fun in as much as he can have fun without emotions. But Geordi is the one who convinces him to go to the holodeck and act out the Sherlock Holmes fantasy, as you said. And you'd think that at some point he would have been inspired to study this himself, how human beings unwind or how they live out their adventure fantasies.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess that he needed the little he's too busy, you know, listening to 10 different kinds of music at the same time when he has some free time to go and reading all of Sherlock Holmes, although it's unclear if Data reads the things or if he just downloads all the books and then he knows them. I don't know. I don't know how Data consumes media. Faster than I do, I will assume. But
oh, yeah. It took me a few months to read all the Sherlock Holmes books. So
that's right. Data. It so happens that you are a big fan of Sherlock Holmes as well.
So, love Sherlock Holmes.
They get to the holodeck and they're doing, I don't know, you probably know what Sherlock Holmes story they were doing. But the problem soon becomes clear that, you know, basically Geordi programs this up. And this is also weird because he programs this simulation, right? And they go into it. And it kind of feels to me like nobody has ever used the holodeck before. And I'm not sure if this is actually the first episode that includes the holodeck. But everyone's like, oh my gosh, it looks so great. How do these things work? What's happening? And I'm like, the holodeck is on the Enterprise. Shouldn't you guys not be super impressed with it?
Yeah, I guess that this is a function of 90s television because they did use the holodeck a few times in season one. But this is back when you couldn't rely on people having watched every single episode up to this point. Mm-hmm. So if you had an unusual piece of technology, you had to give a little primer and then just go into the story from there.
Right.
I think it's another reason why a lot of the early seasons of TNG didn't have many continuous storylines.
Oh, yeah, totally. They're all pretty much episodic, standalone episodes, probably because they were syndicated, right? And and they couldn't control when they were even shown in the order. They may be shown in the wrong order. So it made it difficult. It was a different time, kids, when these were coming out. You had to wait for it to be broadcast. You couldn't just watch the next one immediately.
And if you missed it, you had to go out and buy a blank VHS tape and figure out the VCR. And I remember that.
Yes, it was a dark time. We live in much better times now. which I was thinking about as I was watching this episode on my computer in like a public space. So it was wonderful. I don't know if the other people enjoyed it, but I was wearing headphones. Don't worry.
So there you go.
Yeah. So they come out and the flaw, it becomes readily apparent that there's a flaw in Geordi's plan, because I guess Geordi knows that Data likes Sherlock Holmes. So he's like, hey, let's go solve a Sherlock Holmes mystery, which sounds like fun. But they go, and immediately the problem is that I guess they're replaying one of the Sherlock Holmes stories.
And yes, so, I wish I'd looked up which one, but this is one of the stories that happens in the books, one of the short story books.
The problem is Data has read them all and he remembers them all. So, you know, the setup happens and then immediately Data knows the answer. So he, like, in 2 seconds, he solves the mystery because he knows what.
Now, that's something I wondered about as well, because even if you're not a Lieutenant Commander Data and you've assimilated all the Sherlock Holmes stories with perfect recall, if you want to play through a Sherlock Holmes adventure, chances are it's because you're a Sherlock Holmes fan. You've read the books or seen some of the movies. Mm-hmm. So why would you then play out an adventure that you already know the answer to? Because anyone who's read the stories can do what Data did.
Right, because he just basically – he skips to the big reveal, which is the most memorable part of any Sherlock Holmes story, right? And Geordi is not so happy about it. But I guess this is, you know, you were talking about how Data has to learn how to play.
Yeah.
And he probably just doesn't – he was just looking at it as, oh, it's a problem to solve. I know the answer, so I should solve it as quickly as possible. And Geordi is like, no, we're supposed to – you know, the experience, much like building the model ship, it's the experience of the thing. It's not the solution that is important. And Data is like, oh, right. That's it. And that's where they go to 10 forward, and they're sad in their little Sherlock Holmes outfits, and Dr. Pulaski overhears them talking, and this is when she just rips into Data and basically talks to Geordi as though Data's not even there, which also annoyed me.
My little note here, I guess maybe I agree with you more than I thought. My little note here says, Dr. Pulaski, : still not interesting. So I guess this is before her character arc really got going.
Well, this is early. This is, what, the third episode of season 2?
Yeah, she's only been for 3 episodes. But her point is valid, and I think it's a very, very Star Trek point. One of the reasons why I know this is not a universally beloved episode, but I think that it has some very valid, very classical Star Trek lessons in it, because Dr. Pulaski talks about the value of failure. This is something that Picard also talks about in Tapestry in season 6. It's my favorite episode. Mm-hmm. It's about how our failures can define us. And Data has failed, I guess, but he doesn't see the condition of failure as anything except failure. He doesn't see it as an opportunity the same way that flesh and blood humans do.
Right. And he just sees it as failure, and then you don't really – he doesn't quite understand the concept of why you could learn something from your failure. And this also feeds into the whole, he just wants to solve it as quickly as possible.
Right.
And so this is when Dr. Pulaski decides, I guess we could call this Pulaski's wager. She basically bets with Geordi, although I don't know if they actually wager anything. They may, I don't remember.
There's no money to bet, so.
Oh, that's true. I guess they could. Synthahol. that Data, if given a mystery that Data does not know the outcome of already, he would be unable to figure out the mystery, which seems to me to be kind of a stupid thing to think, because Data is a Starfleet officer, and what they do all the time is problem solving, and solving a mystery is basically like a problem, like problem solving. So it seems like Data is inherently capable of doing it.
And his definition of deductive reasoning is correct when he talks about the way that he reaches conclusions, then pieces facts together. And I guess personally I chalk that up to Pulaski not knowing him very well. She's not a bridge officer per se, so she wouldn't really have served with Data when he's solving all these interesting problems.
That's true. And she just thinks of him as a machine, so she is underestimating what he can do. And it is clear when they go – so she has to dress up, obviously. Everybody has to get dressed up so they can go to the holodeck.
I wonder if people who are serving on the Enterprise ever look askance at these people in period costume just walking down the corridors.
I have many questions about the holodeck. Like, how do you reserve time in the holodeck? It seems like that would be a – especially when you just have 3 days of nothing to do. It seems like they pretty much – Geordi and Data have – the run of the holodeck and nobody else is using it. You would think there'd be a lot of contention for this kind of thing.
Well, rank has its privileges. It's two lieutenant commanders who want it.
It's true. I mean, even when I went to college, it was hard to get a racquetball court. I can't imagine how hard it would be to get a slot in the holodeck. But, they're more evolved people than I am, so they probably have figured it out. Maybe they have a complex algorithm that figures it out for them. Or they just pull rank, as you suggest, and they do what they want.
I mean, it's the future, but it's not that far in the future. I think it's still... People can still throw their weight around a little if they have to.
That's true. And this is when, Dr. Pulaski then stands in for the audience members who don't know what the holodeck is. And she's like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. How does it work? And that gives Geordi an opportunity to tell them how it's a holographic projection and the computer does a bunch of things to fool you into thinking that, the room is larger than it actually is. And while I think the holodeck is a fantastic sci-fi thing, it is problematic in many ways. Like when you have more than two people, I don't even understand how it works because, Dr. Pulaski gets kidnapped, right?
Right.
But where is she? It's like they're in a small room.
The exact same thing because we've seen how big that holodeck space is when the simulation is turned off. So she can't be more than about 10 feet from them at any given time.
Right. And if they're really that concerned, which I guess they weren't, although they figure out that Moriarty has figured out how to turn off all the safety features, they could just beam her out of the holodeck, right? Because they have the sensors.
Yeah.
So there's no – this episode is weird. I like this episode, but there's not much tension because you feel like it's easily resolved, even though Moriarty creates this lever that can cause the Enterprise to shake. And the resolution – well, I know I'm tripping ahead, but the resolution is kind of lackluster.
Well, in my notes, I wrote down that it's very low stakes, start to finish. Even when Moriarty makes the machine that can shake the Enterprise, they're not near some kind of spatial anomaly. They're out in open space. There's not much he can do to hurt them.
And our final sponsor for this episode is Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy Experience at the Intrepid Museum in New York City. I know you're listening to a Star Trek podcast. That means you're into Star Trek. That means you should go to the Star Trek, the Starfleet Academy Experience if you have a chance. It's starting soon, July 9th, which is only a couple of days, and it's going through October 31st, 2016. It's a limited engagement. If you miss it, you've missed it. And this is celebrating the 50th anniversary of Star Trek, and it has all kinds of amazing interactive stuff, including leap motion, projection mapping, holograms, and other Star Trek technologies in this 12,000 square foot interactive journey. You become a cadet in Starfleet, and then they assign you a specialty. So language, medicine, engineering, command, and science. Once you've completed your training, you get commissioned in Starfleet. And once you have your commission in hand, you can go visit the original shuttlecraft from the original series, the Galileo. In addition to the exhibit, the museum is putting on Star Trek-themed events all summer long, such as Star Trek movie nights on the flight deck and astronomy nights with a Star Trek twist. So, the things you need to know, the Intrepid Museum is located on Pier 86, West 46th Street and 12th Avenue in New York City, the town so nice, they named it twice. Visit intrepidmuseum.org/StarTrek for tickets and information. Boldly go. And all he does is he pulls his lever a couple of times. And the biggest problem is that Geordi's model gets cracked a little bit.
It is definitely not the most exciting episode of the show, although I still think it's a pretty decent one.
No. I enjoyed watching this episode. I think also it doesn't help because I mixed it up with the sequel episode, which I think is much more exciting.
Oh, yes. That was a much better episode. Much, much higher stakes for one thing.
Yes. And so I was like, ooh, I remember this episode. This has a really good resolution, but it was a different episode with a different resolution. And so it wasn't quite as exciting. But I will say I enjoyed it. I like the idea. So Pulaski's there. They tell the computer and this is the other thing that I find hard to believe. So Geordi's like, okay, I'm going to tell the computer to create a new Sherlock Holmes mystery that Data can solve. And so they do that, and then it turns out that the computer has just created a pastiche of existing Sherlock Holmes stories and slams them all together. And so once again, Data's like, aha, you pull this thing and a snake comes down, it's going to kill that guy. Mystery solved.
I actually love that part because it's a reference to about three or four different home stories, and I was picking them out going, I know that one, I know that one, I know that one. But
I am a fan of Sherlock Holmes, although I've read a few of the stories, and I do not have an encyclopedic knowledge of Sherlock Holmes. So, so Dr. Pulaski's like, see what I'm saying? He has no chance of actually solving a real mystery. And this is when Geordi's like, okay, I'll show you. Holodeck, create an entirely new Sherlock Holmes-esque story. I'm getting all choked up about Sherlock Holmes. So he says, computer, create an entirely new Sherlock Holmes-esque story, right? But give it a protagonist or an antagonist, I suppose, that can beat Data. And that's the important part.
This is something that I found unbelievable the first time I watched it, and I found unbelievable the second time and this time. Here's what I don't understand. It took Dr. Soong years, if not decades, to create Data and Lore to be these... we assume, based on Measure of a Man, that Data has some measure of consciousness. He is the closest imitation to sapient life you can possibly achieve.
Yes.
And the Enterprise computer does it with basically a power blip on the bridge.
That's right. Yeah, I think he is totally sentient. Data is a living creature, and the holodeck, the computer creates another sentient being in 30 seconds.
How times change.
I know, it's true. And it's crazy. And I was like, I don't understand. And it's so easy, apparently, that I am shocked that not every ship in Starfleet is not being overrun by super intelligent holograms. Because it seems like it's super easy to program one of these things because you just have to say two sentences to the computer and it just does it for you.
Yeah, pretty vague parameters, too. Than Data. Okay, great.
And then they make a big deal about the parameters, and he doesn't actually give it any parameters. He just repeats what he said the first time.
And Geordi acts very contrite about this, like he's made some sort of huge mistake. And I understand it's to give the episode some dramatic weight, but Geordi said pretty harmless things. The Enterprise computer really extrapolated most of it.
It was the computer's fault, I think, at the end of the day.
And to his credit, Picard was not upset about that because it would have been too ridiculous.
It is true. Picard's pretty chill about it, and I think mostly he was happy to have an opportunity to wear a top hat. Let's not kid ourselves.
It was just like watching A Christmas Carol again.
It's true. He should have.
I think he wore that exact same outfit in the 90s Christmas Carol movie, didn't he?
I think he might have. Very reminiscent. It was Dickensian. Yeah. And the other problem I have this episode, I know I seem like I'm slagging this episode off. I think it's a good episode. I think, like you said, it has some good themes and some interesting kind of meaty intellectual problems to think about. The plot is kind of ridiculous, and there are no stakes, so that's a problem.
And slow-paced on top of that. It takes a long time for the story to get going.
It does. It does. Although I like seeing Data dressed up as Sherlock Holmes, so that's good.
Yes.
And I like how much Geordi just throws himself in the beginning into his role as Watson. He picks up the journal and starts writing about how Data's playing the violin and all this stuff. So I thought that was funny. But the other thing is that – so there's an arch that you can – people who've watched Star Trek have seen this. When you're on the holodeck, you say arch or generally you say computer arch, and then it creates an arch that you can – change the parameters of your program or stop it or pause it or do whatever, but do a bunch of stuff on this arch. In this episode, though, it seems that just saying the word arch makes the arch appear, which seems like the worst possible programming ever. I have an Amazon Alexa, and if I just said, you know, if Amazon had programmed it to just be like, you know, just listen all the time, and if Scott says, you know, like, I really should buy some watermelons, then just send him watermelons.
I guess it's the same idea as the comm badges. When anyone can contact anyone from any comm badge, they just assume that no one will abuse it.
That's because they're evolved. They're better people than I am. But it just seems like arch is not that uncommon of a word. So if you're playing, you know, around in your holodeck program and then you just randomly say arch, like in a conversation, it brings you out of the simulation because a giant arch appears.
Yeah, that could break the mood a bit.
Exactly. That's my main problem with it. Although they use it effectively, right? Because I guess generally holograms are programmed to not think about what these things are and kind of just ignore the fact that an arch can appear, an exit door appears. They just ignore it because it's part of their programming.
No, and they didn't. They even got into it a little bit way, way later in Voyager, the John Rhys Davies Leonardo da Vinci hologram, where he gets out of the holodeck and then perceives this alien world as the Italian Renaissance.
Mm-hmm.
So these holograms don't really have any understanding of things outside their program parameters. But Moriarty does, because he's become more intelligent than Data.
That's right, because the computer has whipped up a new sentient being.
I just want to throw this in here real quick if we're talking about Moriarty.
Yes.
Daniel Davis, Niles from The Nanny. Great actor.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't
British
even,
at all.
I didn't make that connection.
Yeah. And in both shows, he has a really, really convincing British accent, but he is from the United States.
Oh, so. I didn't know that. I will say the standout of this episode is Moriarty.
Yes.
He does a fantastic job of playing this kind of they compress it. So, because they spend a lot of time with the whole setup of getting to Sherlock Holmes and Dr. Pulaski making fun of Data, and I think the interesting part is watching him kind of become aware that there is a world that, and he's in. I don't know if he becomes aware that he's a simulation, although later he finds out he's a hologram. But he certainly becomes aware that there's a larger world, and I really like the moment when he is talking to Data and Geordi, and he says, "You both look so strange. And yet, for some reason, I do not find you strange." And so, you know, he's kind of deducing. It's interesting to see him try to deduce from the pieces of information he has that something's going on.
Yeah, it's a great character arc. It's slow burn. He starts off as just Moriarty. And as the story progresses, you see him very, very slowly piece things together with Dr. Pulaski's help, with Data and Geordi's help, and then finally with Picard's help. And it's a believable transition. I don't think the ending felt forced. And I know that we're not talking about the follow-up episode, but when the follow-up episode happens, you can see how that intelligence turned into malice.
Yes. And he lives up to his namesake, right? So he is, you know, Professor Moriarty is the villain that Arthur Conan Doyle created to kill Sherlock Holmes. So he is not a nice man. And he is certainly he one can understand the plight of Moriarty being trapped on the holodeck and all this.
However, I did have one slight complaint about Moriarty in the episode. He's a very, very brilliant professor. And yet, even though the computer has a female voice, he constantly refers to it as Mr. Computer.
That is true. Well, he's sexist, so he just he thinks it's a very high-voiced man, apparently. And I will say, Dr. Pulaski, not a great liar.
No.
Moriarty kidnaps her, basically, and Data and Geordi think that's the mystery that he's supposed to solve. It turns out that there is another mystery that he's supposed to solve, and he, which I think is funny, like the central mystery that the computer creates, is, just kind of Data deals with it like in an offhand, like, oh, this is what happened. Let's go find Dr. Pulaski.
Which is too bad, because that's actually a very classic Holmes mystery, a seemingly impossible murder with a very to the point explanation that's supposed to take a good 40 minutes at least to read and tease out.
Yes, and see, but this proves the point that Data can figure out a mystery on his own. But he thinks that the greater mystery is finding Dr. Pulaski, which is true.
It's
but
true.
It is because, you know, Moriarty is sentient and he's taken her into his laboratory lair, I guess. And he lures them there and basically to demand an explanation of what's happening, I guess. And he figures out that he's on a starship because he figures out how to get the arch and he accesses the data banks, right? And he briefly takes over navigation, which once again makes me question Starfleet security.
Yeah.
But hey, Moriarty's a genius, so maybe he can figure out how to do it. One of my favorite things is he draws the Enterprise on a piece of paper and gives it to Data. And they're just like, we've got to go talk to Captain Picard right now. And Geordi is like, well, why? And Data won't tell him, and they leave. And this is, of course, an interesting thing because they leave. It's a holographic piece of paper, but it leaves the holodeck, but that's a small matter.
I'll let that one slide.
Yes, I will too, because one can imagine, all right, well, it's probably
just paper.
Easier to actually replicate and transport a piece of actual piece of paper into the holodeck, and then a holographic piece of paper. So that's how I'll explain that away. The other thing I love is that he then, Data shows the piece of paper to Geordi, and then Geordi flips it over to show the audience. And the way, and then it's right side up when he's showing it to the camera. So clearly he was looking at it upside down.
I guess to his visual processors, it doesn't make a difference. So
that is true. Maybe it automatically corrects it. Or Geordi is just so, capable of three-dimensional thinking that it, up and down, it doesn't matter to him. The Enterprise has no top, has no bottom. It's in space. It can just rotate all around.
And this is where 28 minutes into the episode, we see Captain Picard for the first time. So it's bizarre. Captain Picard's usually the first and last person you see.
Yeah, he is. He has a pretty small role in this. And basically he's like, you did what? All right, let's go to the holodeck and see if I can figure this out.
Yep.
And I think, once again, I think he is mostly in it so that he can wear a costume. Because he's decided that Moriarty clearly feeds on information. And the less we can give him, the better. So we should not wear our uniforms. So that he can't figure out that we have uniforms? I don't understand the thinking behind that, but
I think it's mostly, as you said, just to get Picard in a top hat.
I think that's that's why the writers did it, but
I know we don't have a ton of time left, but it's something I definitely wanted to bring up, a parallel that I noticed.
All right, well, let's talk about this parallel.
And I'll do it very quick, but
oh no.
The idea of a sentient sapient hologram,
mm-hmm.
who can think and feel and expand beyond his parameters of the holodeck. This is the first time we see a character like the Doctor in Voyager. Without this episode, I don't know if the Doctor would have happened.
That's true. And I was thinking about that as I was watching this because, once again, right, Dr. Zimmerman took years and years and years to get the emergency medical hologram to working and to be, at least kind of bedside mannery and believable. And of course, then the whole plots of Voyager are showing how it takes the Doctor a long time to, become sentient and more of, someone capable of conversation and all this stuff, right? And then the computer is able to do that in, once again, 30 seconds. It creates a perfect interactive sentient being, seemingly, that's holographic. So what was Zimmerman doing?
Well, I guess the holographic Moriarty is more convenient, but the holographic Doctor is more satisfying in terms of an arc.
that is true. They work. Once again, the thing that we learn in this episode, right, is that it is actually the hard work and the journey and not the destination that is the reward and that makes you the person that you are. So if you take an easy shortcut, like just telling the computer, create a doctor capable of being better than Dr. Crusher. that is a cheap way to do it. So you have to do it and earn it yourself.
And that's a good lesson.
It is a good lesson. Kids, don't try to take holographic shortcuts. The more you know. I don't know how I feel about this episode. I like it for the things it makes me think about. And I like it because it highlights how ridiculous the fact that the holodeck exists on a ship. Like, the first thing I would do if I were a captain of a Starfleet ship would be to take the holodeck offline.
I will say that it's not by any means the most egregious of the holodeck episodes.
No, it is not.
As a Sherlockian, I enjoyed all the references. As a Data and Geordi character piece, I liked it, and I really liked the follow-up episode. So, overall... Not bad at all. Would definitely be happy to watch this again.
And this is also, it's starting the bromance that is between Geordi and Data. So that's nice. And anytime you get an episode with Geordi and Data doing something, it's always fun. So overall, I give it a thumbs up. But the sequel episode is far better. So if you only have time to watch one episode of The Next Generation with Moriarty, make it the follow up episode. Don't this one. If you have time for both, watch both.
Yeah, do them back to back. See how things change.
Exactly. Well, Marshall, thank you so much for joining me and chatting about Star Trek.
My pleasure. Scott, thank you so much again for having me on.